Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
And welcome to another episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I figured on this one, I better do the introduction right off the bat before this discussion with Dr. Michael McVicker, who is the author of the 2015 book Christian Reconstruction, R.J. Rush Dooney and American Religious Conservatism. We're going to have that chat in just a minute. The reason I want to do this introduction now, before we get into the chat with Dr. McVicker, is because as I was editing this podcast the other day, I realized that we just kind of dive straight in, and I thought, wait a minute, we never actually talked about who R.J. Rush Dooney was. For some of you who've never heard of him, who don't know who he was, or maybe you have heard of him, I figured I better do a little bit of a brief introduction to R.J. Rush Dooney. Who was R.J. Rush Dooney? Well, he was known as the father of Christian Reconstructionism, Rusus John Rush Dooney. He was born in 1916 in New York State, and just a few months after he was born, his parents moved to Kingsburg, California, which is located about 30 minutes from Fresno. And he would live in California there, Southern California, for the rest of his life. Now, what's interesting about Rush Dooney is that his parents had fled from Armenia. Now, if you know anything about this, the date 1916 is a critical one because that is the midpoint of World War I, which, of course, was from 1914 to November of 1918 is when it ended. Right in the middle of that, he is born. And the reason his parents had fled Armenia, if you know anything about history, you know that there was a genocide of Armenians by the Turks in 1915, and his parents had fled from that and sought political asylum in the United States. Now, why that's important is because Rush Dooney, as he grows up in Southern California, he's surrounded in this Armenian community that he finds himself in. And of course, everyone in that community has got a story about some friend or family member that they knew back in Armenia who had been persecuted and perhaps murdered by the Turks in this genocide in 1915. And out of that, he kind of develops this worldview of a small righteous Christian nation being persecuted by the forces of secular humanism. He would actually blame the Turks. He would say, well, because they were allies with the Germans in World War I, they were reading Nietzsche, and that's where they came across this idea of secular humanism. And this is the basis for their hatred of the Armenians, who were a true Christian nation, one of the oldest Christian nations in the world, if not the oldest. And so you can start to see where he develops this idea of secular humanism and how bad it was, because it led to the Turks persecuting the Armenians for their Christian faith. So as I say, he grows up in Southern California. He goes on to go to UC Berkeley. In 1938, he does an undergraduate degree in English. In 1938, he goes back to UC Berkeley and does an MA in education in 1940. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in this episode. That's important because he kind of comes into Berkeley, which is obviously a very liberal college, a university, kind of as a bit of a liberal himself, into this kind of social gospel idea. It's there that he really starts to harden his position and comes out of there really more or less as a fundamentalist, at least in his political orientation. Then he goes on and does an MDiv in 1944 from the Pacific School of Religion. He gets married in 1943, and then he gets divorced in 1957. There was a bit of controversy around that. We're going to talk about that a little bit. He marries a Dorothy Kingwood in 1962, and they remain married until his death in 2001. Now, what's interesting about Rush Dooney, he goes off after he does his MDiv degree. He goes off with his family. They become missionaries on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation in Nevada for 8.5 years, and it's there that he kind of starts to come up with this idea of what we call Christian Reconstructionism. And again, we're going to talk about that in a bit here on this episode. I don't want to get too much into it, but basically what happened was that Rush Dooney saw the state of the reservation was very poor. We're talking about mid-1940s, late 1940s. It's in a very rough state. There's a lot of alcoholism, there's crime, there's sexual immorality, all sorts of abuses going on. And he starts to wonder, how can we fix this situation? And it's there that he begins to start thinking about in terms of generations. And so this really becomes the genesis of the idea that would become Christian Reconstructionism. And in fact, there's a really good quote from Michael McVicker's book that basically encapsulates what Rushdoony was thinking at this point in time. He says, quote, "Rushdoony reckoned that education based on Christian principles would not only help save the souls of the enrolled children, but over time would also change the culture of the reservation and lead to the spiritual redemption and regeneration of the entire reservation," end quote. And there you see the seeds of what is known as Christian Reconstructionism, which we're going to get into in a little bit. Then after leaving the reservation, he goes on to found the Chalcedon Foundation in Southern California in 1965. It was a think tank, a very small outfit designed to promote a specific model of Christian education organized around the family unit. So for decades, until his death in 2001, he's headquartered there in Southern California, running the Chalcedon Foundation. He produces a huge amount of written work. He traveled, he spoke nationwide, and he promoted his ideas. And so we're going to get into that a little bit more in detail in this episode, but I thought it might be good to do a brief overview of Rushdoony, who he was, and we're going to talk about why he was so influential in just a minute here with Dr. Michael McVicker. I just wanted to mention real quick before we go into the chat that if you want to get a hold of me, if you have any thoughts or questions, comments about this episode or any other, you can find me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also find me on Facebook, the MindShift Podcast Facebook page, and you can look me up there if you want to chat, and I can connect you with Michael McVicker as well. I'll put his email in the show notes if you want to talk with him as well. So let's get on into this chat with Dr. Michael McVicker as we explore the life, the legacy of R.J. Rushdoony, the father of Christian Reconstructionism. I am here with Dr. Michael McVicker. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining me here on MindShift Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Clint.
You are the Associate Professor of Religion at Florida State University, and most importantly for our purposes here, author of a fantastic book called Christian Reconstruction, R.J. Rushdoony and American Religious Conservatism, which came out in 2015. And that's, of course, why I've chased you up, because I've been doing all sorts of episodes, writing research on Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, the Christian right, all these sorts of things. So I think we have obviously a lot in common, because you've written a book on this guy. What led you to get into this? Why Rushdoony? Why Christian Reconstructionism? Because I understand this was actually your doctoral dissertation, was it not?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, it's kind of interesting. I came to it sort of sideways. I started reading about Rushdoony in, it would have been about the mid, like 2000 aughts, around 2005, 2006. And one book in particular comes to mind, Mark Crispin Miller's Cruel and Unusual. That may be something you've come across or maybe some of your listeners. But the basic idea is that there was a sort of groundswell of media coverage of this movement, Christian Reconstruction, and this guy, R.J. Rushdoony, and some kind of insinuation or some kind of sense that he had an outsized but largely misunderstood or neglected sort of influence on both the George W. Bush administration, but also more broadly, the sort of religious right, that it had some kind of influence on Bush. And I guess you could say, too, the war on terror, sort of broadly speaking. Right. And so I kept coming across this guy's name, and I kept seeing him in sort of popular media coverage. I guess you could say sort of left-leaning things that would have been most of it probably now, like Counterpunch magazine. I think BuzzFeed would have run some stuff on this during that period of time, if I'm remembering correctly for when it was founded. But regardless, I would come across these sort of stories about Rushdoony, and so I was always interested in sort of fringe movements, right-wing movements. And so I started digging into it and reading up on Rushdoony, and I realized that this was a character who didn't appear anywhere in the scholarship, and I couldn't figure out why. I couldn't figure out why he wasn't there, especially given the sort of charges of his influence that I was seeing in this kind of journalistic stuff. And so I started digging into it and reading first his theological works, but then sort of trying to track back who was reading his work. And of course, very quickly, I came across his son-in-law, Gary North, and mm-hmm. some of his ideas, which seemed to be even more, if you could call them influential. I think we can talk about that as mm-hmm. we go on with this conversation. But Gary North seemed to be somebody who might have even been more influential than Rush Dooney, especially in the 80s. And so I started tracking him through. And by the time I finished the dissertation in 2010, I'd had about 5 years of working through a lot of Rush Dooney's ideas.
That's a lot. He wrote lot too.
and I didn't scratch the surface, let's be honest. I read the first volume of Institutes of Biblical Law, most of the second volume. Third volume starts to get pretty boring. Mm-hmm. And then there are a lot of his other work. Made it through quite a bit of his stuff on education and American history. But again, I would have only read a fraction of what Rush Dooney wrote during mm-hmm. his lifetime. And then picked up a lot of the other Reconstructionist authors during that period of time. So that's sort of how I came to it. And I can talk more about mm-hmm. The research process and things like that.
But, mm-hmm. Well, speaking of research, I understand the Chalcedon Foundation, they gave you unprecedented access to his sort of personal library. It's kind of a think tank. It was founded by him in 1965. They gave you this unprecedented access. What sort of insights did you glean from looking through all of his, because you saw a lot of his personal correspondence, which hasn't really been published, has it?
Yeah, that's true. You know, I can talk about how I got access, because that actually goes back to the earlier point about my interest in this. But before I go to that, I think to answer your specific question here, it was fascinating. It is a kind of think tank. It's mostly now run by Rush Dooney's son, Reverend Mark Rush Dooney, really nice, very soft-spoken sort of guy. He allowed me access after a long period of negotiation with some middle men, I guess you say, I didn't say middle mm-hmm. person, but let's be honest, they were all men. And they allowed me to come in. And the only sort of limit on my access to the material was a box related to Rush Dooney's divorce. And his son said, I would prefer you not look at that material. And he took me on trust on that. He didn't take it away. He didn't say, you can't look at it. He said, I'd prefer you stay out of it.
So like the forbidden fruit, huh?
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly
I'm going to leave this box right over here. Don't touch it.
Don't touch
now
it.
Now I'm going to leave.
and he let me come in with a camera, and I was able to take pictures of everything.
Wow.
And so I photographed the vast sort of what I could figure out was correspondence. And I honored Rush Dooney's request. I did not look at the divorce papers, partly because I already had the public divorce papers. I already had written, mm-hmm. I think it was in Santa Cruz, the clerk of courts there, and I already had seen them. So there wasn't a lot to see other than mm-hmm. personal material. And I figured I could respect the family on those terms. And it was amazing because, first of all, his library is massive. It's this building that's about the size of an average sort of ranch home with no mm-hmm. partitions in it, and just stuff full of about 40,000, 50,000 volumes. They're organized according to some kind of idiosyncratic method that he had come up mm-hmm. with, like theology was here, history was there, and then it would be scattered everywhere else. Mm-hmm. But the
not
amazing
on the Dewey
thing,
decimal system.
not that I could tell. If, yeah. if it was, he had abandoned any kind of real systematic approach
right.
to it.
He knew where all the sections were, I'm sure, in his mind.
Yeah. Well, my understanding is he had a photographic memory, and so he could tell his kids, he would give the family folklore. He would give his daughter like a dime, and he would say, go get this book. And he would say, it's on this shelf in this section of the library, this many books over. And he would give her a dime or a penny, and she'd go off and get it and retrieve it. That's the lore. I have no idea. I can't prove it.
Wow.
But he would have correspondence. What he would do is he would just take... Initially, at some point, somebody had tried to put things into file cabinets, and they were file cabinets with your manila folders with labels, and he just stopped using them, and he would just shove correspondence anywhere he could on the shelves. So you would pick up correspondence from 1956, and it would be Cornelius Van Til, sort of one of his mentors, mm-hmm. and right beside it would be a stack of papers from 1980, whatever, correspondence on homeschooling, like legal defense fund stuff.
Right.
And he would take notes on anything that was at hand. So there would be correspondence, and right on the back of it would be a grocery list. You know, one of the things that was the sort of most human to me was I was going through it and I came across a diploma, and it was an honorary diploma from some Christian school in California. I don't remember what it was. I've got mm-hmm. notes on it. I could look it up. And it was an honorary diploma that was given to him for giving the commencement speech to this place. On the back of it, He had just started writing a manuscript. This was how sentimental Rush Dooney was. It was purely instrumental. He flipped it over. On the back was, you know, whatever, something about, you know, systematic theology. And there
was a blank space. Let's fill it up. It's the back of a diploma. Oh, well, that was only an honorary degree. So it wasn't an earned doctorate or whatever.
that's right. He was a graphomaniac. He was just sitting on the right. So that was the sort of state of the archive. And to a degree, I probably put it in better order than what Chalcedon's betters
had. System was.
Yeah. Now he
didn't sound like he didn't have a system.
They didn't.
It left just to its own devices.
Yeah.
As he left it, sounds like.
Yeah, you could imagine he just walked in one day and walked out.
Yeah,
that's what it looked like. It's exactly what it looked like.
Well, it's fascinating because when I read through your book, it seems to be, I wasn't sure, obviously, what I was getting into. I knew it was obviously about Reconstructionism and Rush Dooney. His picture's on the front of the book. But what struck me is it goes through, it's more of a history than like a real deep dive into his theology or his biblical studies or whatever. One of the things that struck me was that looking at his interactions with other Christians through his life, he was a full-on fundamentalist. He really was. I mean, he would go to war and did on many occasions. Of course, he fell out with his own son-in-law, Gary North. I'm not sure if they ever really reconciled. There's some talk that maybe they did a little bit toward the end, but yeah, who knows? They didn't speak for the rest of his life, I guess, even over the most minute theological disagreements. Mm-hmm. What does that reveal about his sort of worldview? Because obviously he's a Calvinist. He's influenced by Van Til, Kuyper, some of these people, Calvin himself. What does that reveal, or does it reveal anything about sort of his orientation?
Yeah, that's it's a great question. And it's one that, you know, even after spending 5 years with him and sort of living in his head, I never got a clear sense of, you know, sort of what came first. And maybe that's the wrong way to look at it. I'm obviously not a psychologist and I'm not trained in that way. And I avoided doing any kind of psychoanalytic or psychological sort of work on Rush Dooney because it would have been daunting to begin with, even with the sort of personal access that I had. But I guess I'd answer it in two ways. The first is, it was apparent reading both his journals, which he started at a very young age. As best as I could tell, he started some kind of systematic journaling in early adulthood. I don't know if I saw them all, but you know, I was able to find journals back into his time at Berkeley. And
we're talking 1930s.
Yeah, 1930s mm-hmm. and 40s. Mm-hmm. And you know, he exhibited a very combative sort of personality at that point that was not necessarily theological yet, right? You might be able to call it ideological. That is, he was sort of locating himself in a left-right sort of political spectrum, interested in, you know, he started kind of on the left. He was a member of the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union. He was a kind of union guy when he was young and seemed to be sympathetic to social gospel sort of thinking.
To more liberal in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah, and so kind of. And then by the time he finished at Berkeley, UC, University of California, Berkeley, he had sort of gone pretty hard right and abandoned a lot of that sensibility. And so you could see he was sort of judging his friendships based on these kind of ideological commitments. So you could see elements of that early on. And then by the time he finds Van Til's work, he'd already been very conservative in sort of a Calvinist sense and a reform sense. And by the time he finds Van Til's work and he settles on this idea of presuppositional thought, where you have to filter all of your thinking through Van Til's reading of scripture. When he settled on that, he seems to have gone very hard into the sort of fundamentalist mindset that you're talking about. So you could see bits and pieces of this very early on, but by the 1940s, it sort of clicks and his thinking becomes very machinic. And if you're on the outside of it, he doesn't want much to do with you. He'll argue with you. He'll try to reach you. He may even try to, in a presuppositional sense, sort of evangelize to you, you know, tell you, which is basically saying the way you think is wrong.
You're not relying on the Bible and divine inspiration. You're a humanist. You're a secularist or whatever you are. Yeah, it's very and white sort of thinking.
Yeah. And so he would try to pull people that way. And if he couldn't, he would reject you. And so you can see that with his relationship with like Christianity Today, even though these are conservative evangelicals, many of whom are Reformed, right? In their sort of background, some Baptist leaning, but still conservative Baptists, he rejects them, right? Very quickly after trying to work with them because they won't come around to this presuppositional way of thinking. So I don't know if that really answers the question other than to say, I don't know if it was the theology that drove it, but it certainly heightened it, right? It made it more clear and it focused his thinking that way.
It sounds like it because you talk about in the book, I think there's some key events in his life, one of which was he was a missionary straight out of Bible college or seminary in this reservation in Nevada. And at some point during his tenure there, he stumbled across the work of Van Til. And it was like the light bulbs just came on. It seemed like he just devoured the first book. I don't know which book he was reading at that point, but that was it for him, wasn't it? It just clicked. And he's like, I have found a person here who can explain everything and it all makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's true. It was the new modernism. Van Til's the new modernism. And he runs into it when he's on the reservation. And, you know, a big component of that for Rush Dooney is when he was at Berkeley, when he was doing his secular education, he was a student of Ernst Kantorowicz. And Kantorowicz was a very conservative, in his own way, sort of historian, wrote a really famous book among historians, intellectual historians, legal historians, called The King's Two Bodies, which was this look at, I'll simplify greatly, but it was this look at sort of medieval conceptions of kingship and the durability of kingship and legal thinking. And Kantorowicz basically said, look, all modern law is rooted in theological thinking. Right. And Rush Dooney picked that up and thought, this seems to be right. And when he encounters Van Til, Van Til seems to provide a framework that jibes with Kantorowicz's notion of law and theology as a foundation for politics. Right. You've got Kantorowicz who has the political side, and you've got Van Til who has the theological and epistemological side. And when he's able to reconcile those two, he's able to look at, for instance, the reservation that he's on and say, ah, the problem here is the way humanists think in relationship to regulating people's behavior. If they had Christian presuppositions, it would look different than it does currently, right? And so he begins starting to hammer all of his missionary activity into that worldview and into that framework, and eventually starts associating with folks that would be what we would consider today sort of libertarian in their thinking. And he's trying to synthesize those ways of thinking. So that's
all
certainly
starts coming together.
Yes.
It seems like his time on the reservation, it was critical in many ways. For one thing, he comes across Van Til and some of these other writers. I'm not sure when he picked up the work of Abraham Kuyper and the whole sphere sovereignty model, but when he starts to envision this, as you say, this worldview, it seemed to me like, okay, that's the seedbed of really his conception of Christian Reconstructionism. If we could just raise up enough generations of godly children, and of course that goes to the homeschooling and Christian schooling piece, the best way to do that is through Christian homeschool and Christian schools. Eventually, there'll be enough of us and we'll just take dominion. You know, and I thought, okay, so this is where it starts, is on the reservation where he starts to think, ah, this is my program. This is my life's work here.
Yeah, that's correct. So he encounters Van Til, and he also encounters the work of Herman Duyverd. And I'm not, my
pronunciation. Your Dutch isn't good?
Of the Dutch names, yeah, is not as good as it could be. I've been corrected by a couple of folks on this. But that is where he picks up Kuyper's sphere sovereignty. It's through the work of these two Dutch theologians. And, you know, it's worth noting, you know, Rush Dooney is instrumental first in bringing almost everything that Van Til publishes after the new modernism to print. He essentially becomes a kind of shadow editor. And also the work of Duyverd. The Presbyterian Reform Publishing House starts publishing that material on sphere sovereignty, and it helps rekindle interest in Kuyper too, the sort of neo-Calvinism renaissance that takes place during that period in time as a kind of response to the Niebuhrs and the more liberal sort of leaning theologians in the United States. So it's a really sort of complicated thing that Rush Dooney is participating in as a kind of bit player. It's in the 40s and the 50s where he encounters the sphere sovereignty stuff. And as you said, it works perfectly with what he sees going on in the reservation, because the reservation becomes a microcosm. It's a state institution that is completely regulated by federal land management rules, the federal government, and you've got these Native American population on the reservation having to navigate that. And he says, if I can Christianize these folks, they can learn to rebel against statism. Mm-hmm. And that's what he tries to do.
Exactly.
And in some ways, he's effective. They take over the school board, and past that, I don't really know what happens. He does get more Native Americans elected to the school board, and as a consequence, they seem to have had a majority voting role, and then he leaves. So I don't know exactly what his reforms were after mm-hmm. that.
But, what happened after that?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because that's essentially, in many ways, the model that we've seen in the Christian right, isn't it? The dominionist angle. Christians need to be taking over. They need to be running these various, well, one aspect is the Seven Mountains mandate, the mm-hmm. Seven Mountains of culture, education, art, media, government. You know, that's the biggest, one of the biggest ones. And so here's Rush Dooney doing this stuff back in the, early mid 1940s. So he was way ahead of his time in that sense, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And, you know, in terms of like the Seven Mountains stuff, that certainly comes in later. And it seems that that seems to have had a clear influence from Reconstructionist thinking, mm-hmm. right? Coming into charismatic and sort of Pentecostal circles. But, you know, Rush Dooney begins, he wouldn't have used the language of Seven Mountains, of course, himself. His was explicitly the sphere sovereignty stuff. And, you know, he begins to develop that very clearly in the 1950s and the 1960s. And for him, it really is a response to what's happening in the sort of American right wing, broadly speaking. You've got the John Birch Society forming in the late 1950s. You've got the development of sort of Goldwater style republicanism in the early 1960s. You've got proto-libertarian sort of thinking, anti-statist, anti-New Deal thinking. And so Rush Dooney sees all of this stuff and he starts thinking to himself, how can we turn this Christian idea of sphere sovereignty from Kuyper into a way for modern American Christians to understand their role in society, right? And so he will see media, government, the family, the mm-hmm. state, schools, as these individual spheres that will look a little bit like what will eventually come to be the Seven Mountains sort of theology mm-hmm. later. So he does lay that kind of foundation for it intellectually.
So although he is the father of Christian Reconstructionism, what about the Dominion theology piece? Because it seems like as time goes on, okay, people don't necessarily quote him or cite him overtly, but his fingerprints are all over the Christian right. I mean, Sarah Diamond said that basically he's the architect of the modern Christian right. He provides the theology, the philosophical, the biblical background. He already had all these volumes written by the time the Moral Majority and organizations like that were starting to be founded in the late 70s and early 80s. He'd already written stuff 20 years before that. So what's his role in that whole Christian right piece?
Yeah, well, this is the one where I'm the most cautious when it comes to talking about his influence, because you know, you're certainly right. By the end of the 1960s, Rush Dooney has essentially laid out a political theology, right?
Rooted the whole system.
It's very
comprehensive.
It's comprehensive. It's systematic. You have to do a lot of work to pull it all together, right? Mm. And so later thinkers would, like Greg Bahnsen and Gary North and David Chilton, these sort of second and third generation Reconstructionists, they would come along and try to give this a more sort of, not just systematic, but a more practical gloss, how you could translate this into local activism, how you could translate it into grassroots, you know, fundraising, all of this kind mm-hmm. of stuff, right? And they would go on and do that in the late 70s and the early 80s. But the challenge that I have in thinking through this as a historian is Rush Dooney certainly had a major intellectual influence. By the late 1970s, I've been able to see his work on college syllabi, right? Mm-hmm. Seminary syllabi,
yeah, law
right?
schools.
Law schools. Mm-hmm.
Oral Roberts, you know, and Regents.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. You'll see it there. Another major area where you'll see it is in small Christian academies. Mm-hmm. You'll see his, especially the institutes, but really in particular, his writings on American history, this independent republic and the nature of the American system. You'll see those two works regularly on high school and even advanced grade school syllabi mm-hmm. or recommended reading lists. Okay.
Christian high schools. Let's just
Christian high schools. Yeah. I'm not aware of many state schools.
Many public schools. Yeah. Unless they want to use it as a case study.
Yes.
He didn't like statist or government schools, that's for sure. But
no, certainly not. So you'll see this influence at the same time in the 70s and in the 80s, while you've got Pat Roberts and Jerry Falwell, these other folks running around making their own sort of case for Christian activism. They may be using language dominion or language of sphere sovereignty, but, you know, finding these direct sort of traces where you can say, you know, so-and-so Red Rush Juni, who influenced Francis Schaeffer, who gets picked up by Jerry Falwell, that direct lineage is oftentimes very hard to trace, right?
It is.
So what I end up coming, at least in my, the way I wrote it in the book, to even to this day, I sort of stand beside this. What I see is that Rush Juni developed a network of ideas and also a network of activists through the homeschooling movement, through the Christian sort of legal defense movement, where most folks wouldn't have read all of the Institutes or Salvation and Godly Rule or The Nature of the American System or some of these other books. Many of them would have read something like The Messianic Character of American Education, especially in the homeschooling movement. So you'll find people who have read bits and pieces of all of this stuff. And instead of picking up a systematic sort of idea of dominion from Rush Juni, which is very specific for Rush Juni, it's about family, it's about patriarchy, it's about generational change on the scale of hundreds of years, not in terms of election cycles, right? What you'll see is people will pick up some of that rhetoric and then dump the rest of it, right? And so you can see that Pat Robertson in particular picks it up, some of the particularly like Herbert Titus and some of his folks at the law school at Regent, you'll see them pick up some of this rhetoric, but they don't necessarily pick up the systematic thinking that Rush Juni provided. So I guess this is a long way to come back to your question. Yes, there's very clear indirect evidence that Rush Juni's ideas mattered, but there's very little direct evidence that people were taking this revolutionary idea about generational change as seriously as Rush Juni wanted them to, which in fact, by the end of his life, is what leaves Rush Juni very embittered. And this goes back to your question about him being a fundamentalist, right? He ends his life in some ways very bitter at the people around him for not taking his familial view of Christian Reconstruction seriously. And this is also where he and Gary North part ways. And back to your question about them reconciling, I don't know. I don't know if they ever came back on this, but they split over this idea about the role the family played versus this more sort of blunt force political change that some wanted to advocate for through the Republican Party and that kind of more direct political action. So I've talked your question to death and sort of filibustered. But
you're
that's
not a politician, are you?
Yes. I'm
maybe you should run for office.
I want to say everything's complicated and then talk.
It's very complicated. That's what I found. As you say, you don't find his name, but you find his fingerprints on things. You'll hear phrases. I came across a book that a woman on the Texas school board wrote, and she used the phrase Molech worship and public schools. And I'm like, that's Rush Juni. There's no way you did not get that from anyone else except for Rush Juni. And, you know, you hear things. I was listening to Sarah Posner's book on Audible today, Unholy. It's just come out, and she's talking about the Christian right. And one of the things that struck me was they don't use the language of sphere sovereignty, but I think in a lot of ways, of course, Rush Juni was concerned about government overreach, I guess they would say today, into the Christian home and into the church, making you do things against your conscience, like bake a cake for a gay couple or whatever it might be. And so, you know, you see there must be an influence somewhere, whether or not you can exactly pinpoint Rush Juni in it.
That's exactly right. And this is the challenge of both. It's a challenge of both thinking through the role of, broadly speaking, conservative evangelical Protestantism. And with that, I would roughly put fundamentalists like Rush Juni into that, although that gets complicated, right? We have to define fundamentalist and evangelical, and I'll leave that one. I'll drop that like a hot potato. But at the same time, you have so many different sort of traditions in the United States of Christians advocating for direct governmental sort of either direct intervention by Christians in the government or the government creating spaces where Christians are free to act independently of the government and essentially allowing Christians spaces of governance outside mm-hmm. of the state, right? And Rushdoony was on the side of both of those sort of trends. And so you'll find where folks who sound much more, I guess you'd say, liberal theologically mm-hmm. can sound a little bit like Rushdoony, especially if they're libertarian, right? In their outlook. But then at the same time, you'll find folks who are very theologically conservative who sound a lot like Rushdoony. And those folks may be either directly or indirectly parroting Rushdoony, or they may be hearkening back to the foundational ideas that Rushdoony was pulling on himself, right, in the mm-hmm. 50s and 60s. You know, probably the most concrete today is this idea that the United States is a republic and not a democracy, right? Mm-hmm. That's an old idea. In part, it goes back to the founding, right? This debate between popular sovereignty and representational limited sovereignty, right? The whole problem between the electoral college versus popular elections, right? And a lot of those ideas get channeled in particular through Southern thinkers after the Civil War and after Reconstruction. And Rushdoony found that stuff very compelling. So he mm-hmm. goes back to people like Dabney, right? And he goes back to pre-antebellum thinkers who were defending slavery. And Rushdoony himself, you know, he had this very specific view of biblical slavery mm-hmm. that he would defend that wasn't exactly, you know, Southern style chattel slavery, right? So he picks up all of these ideas and reconfigures them. And on the other side, you have something that is anti-democratic, anti-statist, and vaguely pro-slavery. And you can find those ideas all over the American right, sure. right? And are they getting it from Rushdoony, or are they getting it from the John Birch Society, which is another channel for this?
Yeah, but he was affiliated with it, with John Birch. Yes, exactly.
He was a non-dues-paying member of the John Birch Society, right? Very careful, right?
Very careful. Yes. Exactly. We'll have you as a member, but I don't want to pay dues because I don't want my name to appear on any rolls. But yet he was affiliated with these guys from way back in the mm-hmm. day in the sort of California Sunbelt area. There is one thing you did mention, and maybe we could circle back around. Okay, so he's influential, even though his influence is not necessarily, you can pinpoint, say, that's Rushdoony in the Christian right, evangelical political movement, the whole Dominionists, some of the ideas they picked up from him, though not exactly everything. But what about Christian homeschooling, Christian education? Mm-hmm. How important is Rushdoony? Because his legacy there, according to people on the Chalcedon Foundation website, they say, look, there wouldn't be Christian homeschooling today if not for the work of Rushdoony, both in terms of his writings and then his legal advocacy. Something that struck me the other day, I mean, his background in education was, you know, that's what he was. He went to Berkeley to be a teacher. Education seemed like was his maybe first love. I don't know. So he writes all these books on education and attacking statist schools and everything. So what's his legacy there in terms of Christian education and homeschooling?
Well, I think I think Chalcedon's right. You know, I mm-hmm. think that is his chief sort of legacy. And it's a legacy that I don't know if I would go so far as to say there wouldn't be homeschooling without Rushdoony, because there were a lot of folks, as Milton Gaither, right, mm-hmm. I know you've also interviewed, as he's noted, there were folks coming from left, right, and center, right, on this problem of homeschooling over the 1950s, 60s, 70s, right, advocating for it in a lot of different ways. But I do think that if it weren't for Rushdoony building a coalition where he was willing to work with people on the left, he was willing to work with people on the far right, he was willing to work with Scientologists, right? There's correspondence in his archive where he's corresponding with Scientologists, where they're advocating for homeschooling. The Amish, it didn't matter. He was willing to work with any of these folks because his idea was ultimately that if he could build a strong enough coalition with a robust enough legal foundation that recognized the sort of religious and ideological pluralism, mm-hmm. right, underlying homeschooling advocates, he was in hopes he could build a coalition that would pass most First Amendment tests, right? Mm-hmm. You're not doing this to establish Christian homeschools. You're doing it to establish, broadly speaking, homeschooling as a right, right? Mm. And so Rushdoony saw that, and he was willing to build those networks, which is really ironic or paradoxical, given your point earlier about his fundamentalism, right?
Exactly.
It was always the Christian that was ideologically and theologically nearest to him that was the enemy, right? So he would spend page after page in journals and diaries attacking Billy Graham or you know, who's very conservative, but also ecumenical kind of in some ways, right? Or his, you know, dispute with his own son-in-law. But yet he would sit down and work with a lawyer from the Church of Scientology on an issue in, you know, Tampa Bay. So it really remarkable,
remarkable
that he would do this. And I think you're right, and Chalcedon's right. If it weren't for that activism and networking all of these people together and teaching a lot of young, really bright, really conservative Christian men who wanted to grow up to be lawyers, importance of using the legal system to achieve these goals, I don't think it would have happened in the way that it did. I think we might have homeschooling, but I think it would look different. And if you think about his work with John Whitehead at the Rutherford Institute, he helped launch that institution. It was largely over homeschooling. And to this day, you know, Rutherford's really important when it comes to sort of a vaguely libertarian sort of Christian ethos. So it's a really interesting sort of dynamic that he helped cultivate. And he had a huge influence on Christian law schools as a consequence. And, you know, this goes back to the idea of direct influence, maybe not so much. Indirect influence, there's piles of it, right, everywhere.
Absolutely. So, it's huge, isn't it? I mean, you go as far as, I heard a NPR interview with Michelle Bachmann, and she was talking about when she was at Oral Roberts University. I think she might have been the first year that they opened the ORU Law School. One of the professors, he just used institutes as biblical law. That was one of his textbooks in the law school. So she was influenced by Francis Schaeffer, R.J. Rush Jr. Those were the big sort of guns at the time, late 70s, early 80s. So yeah, he pops up in seemingly strange places, but there he is again. So we talk about some of his influences on homeschooling, Christian education, the Christian right, but it seems like, as we've said, people have shied away from some of his more extreme views. Maybe we can talk about that, because what were some of his extreme views? He certainly had some things that turned a lot of people off. They might have bought into some of his stuff, but man, when you get into some of the weeds, my God, it's pretty weird.
Yeah, I mean, this is the, you know, if your listeners are all familiar with Rush Dooney and the Institutes, they probably know something about all of the crimes that he had enumerated, where the death penalty is the, you know, the ultimate punishment. I don't even know what they, I don't even know how many he had off the top of my head.
27, I heard.
Yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and confirm from the sources. But, you know, they run from everything from, you know, witchcraft to incorrigible children, which he didn't mean like a three-year-old that, you know, kept breaking the rules. He meant, you know, like a 30-year-old.
Repeat offender, yeah.
Like some kind of habitual recidivist when it came to some kind of major crime. Homosexuality is probably the most notorious, right? So he's got all of these different rules. And, you know, Gary North, his son-in-law, went so far as to talk about, you know, the act of stoning a, you know, a habitual criminal as, you know, a kind of communal effort, right? Because everybody's had to participate.
Bring
you
back know, stoning.
And of course, if you go back to where I started the conversation, you're asking why I was interested in it. You know, North's writing on stoning became very popular during the early 2000s because of the invasion of Afghanistan, a conflict with the Taliban, which did stone women in particular, but, you know, criminals in Afghanistan. And so there were a lot of writers who were talking about, like, this is the American Taliban, right? Comparing Rush Dooney and North and the Reconstructionists to the Taliban. And, you know, the charge there is, you know, in some ways apt, but for the Reconstructionists, it was all intellectual exercise. What would this look like eventually, right? Because this goes directly back to your question here. You know, all of this extreme views that the Reconstructionists took for the death penalty for this, or, you know, slavery as a penalty for habitual indebtedness, right? Debt peonage is actually in the Old Testament, right? If you're if you have to go into debt, you can eventually become a slave and then be emancipated, you know, over all the different rules associated with buying and, you know, jubilees and all this kind of stuff. Rush Dooney wrote on that sort of stuff extensively. So there's this kind of intellectual exercise with enumerating what biblical law would do that takes you into these very extreme sort of thought experiments, right? And I would recommend anybody pick up just a chapter of the Institutes of Biblical Law, because that's essentially what it is. Each chapter is a thought experiment related to one commandment in the, you know, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And then he goes through the entire Old Testament and New Testament, scouring it for, here's how the first commandment was enforced, right? If somebody violated it, here's how it's enforced. And then he would go and look at contemporary issues, right? How would you enforce it today, right? And how do we not enforce it, okay? So you've got all these sort of then extreme thought experiments that he would go through progressively in the institutes. And as you can imagine, a lot of folks would encounter this and say, well, I'm not going to go for the stoning of homosexuals or the public execution of Muslims or Hindus or, you know, whatever. But in the 1950s, the 1960s, where he starts cooking up these ideas, you know, you have to take them in context of the moment where a lot of Americans are looking at the Union, the Republic, and saying it's coming undone, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the civil rights movement. You've got, you know, riots. You've got crime. You've got
counterculture.
Counterculture.
Vietnam War protests, all that. Yeah.
Yeah. You've got this wide context of social upheaval, right? Not unlike today in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And what a lot of folks were doing were saying, whoa, this guy seems to have provided a way of thinking about the present in conversation with this ancient biblical past. And so this is why Bachman would have been reading you know, the Institutes in law school. Not necessarily because the law professor was probably, I would guess, wasn't necessarily advocating for the murder of, you know, whatever sinner.
Incorrigible teens.
Right, exactly. But was trying to say to that law school cohort, how could a Christian think through these problems, right? So in that sense, the Institutes are bonkers, but they're really instructive.
Right? Yeah, you know? It's a window into his mind or his theology. It's tough sledding at times, isn't it? You kind of have to skim a little bit and skim a little bit more till you come to something that's got some meat on it. It's just a fascinating thing. Reading through his works, I've been doing a ton of research and writing on his impact on Christian homeschooling. And you talk about the legacy of a guy like Michael Ferris. Okay, surely there are connections between Rush Dooney and Michael Ferris. I don't think Ferris is a card-carrying Reconstructionist, but obviously they worked together on the Coalition on Revival. So there's a connection there. It's a very Dominionist sort of worldview position papers and all this. Then he goes on to found the HSLDA, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And then he founds Patrick Henry College. And so now he's got this whole pipeline for homeschool Christian kids to go off to a university, get a bachelor's degree. I guess they're accredited now. But in that process, they are putting them into the White House as interns for the Trump administration, well, as far back as George W. Bush, congressmen, senators, Supreme Court justices. That's a Dominionist mandate right there. They're trying to carry that out. They're saying we need to put as many Christians that have been raised with a biblical worldview in homeschooling into politics and legal fields and all the rest of it. I mean, to me, that's Rush Dooney's legacy being carried out by Michael Ferris.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's absolutely right. I mean, Ferris, especially through the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund, I mean, this is the kind of organization where when Rush Dooney is working in the late 70s, right, he's laying the foundation for that organization. And he's laying the foundation for a number of essentially homeschooling legal networks, right? And so many of those sort of first generation of lawyers and thinkers are going to have, in one way or another, either a direct or indirect connection to Rush Dooney's network, right? You know, one of the more sort of notorious, I guess you could call it, and I'm gonna use this advisedly, but sort of conspiracy theories associated with Rush Dooney and the right wing is the importance of the Council for National Policy, which is this kind of exclusive members-only networking.
Very secretive.
Yeah, very secretive. They have secret membership roles and all of that. Rush Dooney was a member for a time, and then he drops out. Somebody he claimed paid his membership dues for a time. It was probably Gary North. It seemed, but you know, who knows? I should
Makes
be careful
sense.
About that. I don't know that for certain, but I suspect it was someone either like North or associated with North. But what Rush Dooney does is when he's working as a member of the CNP, he's really using that for his homeschooling networking. Right. Mm-hmm. And he's making connections with ministers and educators and policy sort of wonks in the education realm. Mm-hmm. And that's in the late 70s, early 80s is when he's really developing that sort of network. And that's going to be the sort of foundation for the Legal Defense Association for homeschooling and so many of those other, the Rutherford Institute, so many of these other kind of legal associations. And so Ferris and a lot of those lawyers who would have been, you know, young up-and-comers at that point in time, they're right in that network. Whether they met Rushdie, I don't know. I'd have to go back. There may be a meeting, you know, direct meeting, but it doesn't matter. They are indirectly associated with that network that he built through the Council for National Policy.
He's on the ground floor of a lot of these things, because you mentioned that he was working with Jerry Falwell Sr. in the late 70s when the Moral Majority was being founded. I'm not sure if he was a part of it, but he certainly was in some of those discussions leading up to it. So he must have had some input. And I'm thinking too, you say you're a historian. Well, then I'm sure you're familiar with good old David Barton. He's the American Evangelicals, quote unquote, historian. But he's always going around talking about the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. So I think he's not going to say, I got this from Rush Dooney. But you can look at, he does all sorts of talks on YouTube where he talks about the importance of the Ten Commandments as a guide for voting, as a political guide. And he argues that the Ten Commandments were the basis of American law and all this other stuff, you know. So surely Rush Dooney's fingerprints have got to be on some of Barton's work.
Yeah. Well, I think that Rush Dooney, especially for guys like Barton, Rush Dooney was part of a generation of, you could call them scholars, you could call them popularizers. You know, like Rush Dooney obviously wasn't affiliated with like a Christian university. He tried to found one, but gave that up. But there were a group of sort of thinkers, you know, Van Til being one of them, right, in this generation that really laid the groundwork for what Barton is doing. It really takes the sort of explosion of the sort of end of the sort of Protestant establishment in the 19 teens and 20s, where a lot of sort of liberal social gospel leaning Christians move into the more established, what we think of as disciplines today, like sociology and history. And they bring a lot of those Christian convictions into those areas, but they sort of secularize them, right? I mean, today you'd be talking about people like George Marston, right? Who are deeply influenced by this Christian heritage, but they sort of secularize it. Rush Dooney was part of a generation of guys who said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep it explicitly Christian, right? And that lays the foundation for the Bartons and a lot of these popularizers today. And whether Barton, I haven't read Barton in years. I remember the Jefferson book that was
The Jefferson Lies.
Yeah, The Jefferson Lies that was yanked a few years ago from, I think it's the last thing by Barton I've read. But there's certainly, Barton's early stuff shows a reliance on Rush Dooney-ish kind of thinking. And, you know, the nature of the American system and this independent republic are really fascinating reads for the way they try to make this kind of Christian reinterpretation of American history that really was, you could almost call it countercultural in the 1960s. It was trying to pick up like what the John Birch Society was doing and say, yes, but the John Birch Society isn't religious enough, right? Let's take it one step further, right?
Not fundamentalist enough.
Yes, exactly. And then you get, you know, over the subsequent generations, people like Barton picking up those ideas.
Sure. What do you think is his enduring legacy? This is my last question then, because you were talking about at the end of his life, he seems kind of sad and morose. I was listening to on YouTube, there's a recording, I don't know if you've come across this, but he recorded it about 2 months before he died. It was his last public recording. And it's about almost 30 minutes long. And it's really fascinating because he goes through a lot of stuff that we've talked about, the things that impacted him on in his life and his vision of sort of this dominionist theology. But he says at the end, he says, you know, I'm almost 85. I don't think very many people have picked up my ideas. So I hope that they pick it up after I die, basically. So what's his legacy, though? What do you see as his enduring legacy?
Yeah, well, that first of all, I'm embarrassed to say I have not heard that. I'm going to have to dig
I'll send you the link.
Yeah, I need to listen to that. But, you know, to answer your question, I think we've already answered in part. The homeschooling thing is profoundly sort of associated with it. And again, you know, maybe to Rush Dooney's disappointment, the theological foundation in sphere sovereignty and sort of reformed Calvinist thinking is not necessarily what undergirds the sort of Christian homeschooling movement as much as he would have liked, okay? But even then, I think that's a major component of the legacy. The other component of it that is really important to my mind is the libertarian sort of thinking, right? There are elements of this that I'll encounter some fringe politician working in the sort of far edges of the Republican Party or right-wing sort of thinking. And there'll be all of this stuff about sheriffs and godly rule, right? Mm-hmm. And the primary magistrate is the sheriff. Now, I can't say for certain that that person read this Independent Republic, but I'm pretty sure that that idea came from directly from somebody who read Rush Dooney and filtered this out. Now, you know, there's also Latter-day Saints who have similar ideas because of their really aggressive stand against federal intervention in the American West with land management. So they put a heavy emphasis on sheriffs like the Bundys, if you're familiar with them. Those folks have a lot of overlap. I don't think there's a direct connection there with Rush Dooney, but I do think that when Protestant evangelicals mention it, it's because of an interesting convergence here with Rush Dooney and Latter-day Saints sort of thinking in this area. Gold standard folks. Mm-hmm. That's a primary area where Gary North and Rush Dooney are sort of overlapping.
Right. Hard money and everything.
Hard money. Some of your preparedness advocates, especially people advocating not so much the arming of, say, a family for some kind of apocalyptic event, but say churches or communities. Those folks, I suspect, have been in one way or another influenced by his sort of biblical thinking about preparedness. And there's a whole generation of people that come after him that develop those ideas. So, you know, that's a way of saying, I guess, in some ways, these are movements that you could argue are on the fringes, right, of American politics. But in a lot of ways, they're not. They're right at the core of a kind of libertarian ethos, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is where it gets very difficult to say, is it Milton Friedman or is it Rush Dooney that's the influence here? Well, in fact, it's a kind of synergy, right? And it's a matter of whether one is more secularly inclined or whether one is more sort of Protestant and evangelical. Then you're going to find them emphasizing things that sound very Rush Dooneyite. So those are the areas where I see it. Libertarianism, homeschooling, and with that, the influence of a certain kind of familial model.
Patriarchy. Yeah.
Quiverful. You know, one of the things that I've always been struck by is folks who have now started families where the parents will not get a birth certificate for their child. Right. And these tend to be a very specific kind of Christian, oftentimes reformed, a lot of them living in the Midwest, Texas, places like that. And very specifically, they'll talk about this Moloch worship kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. Don't give your child over to the state. Well, how could you avoid that? Don't give them a birth certificate.
Don't even register them. The state doesn't know they exist.
Which is an incredibly radical thought.
It is.
And these people are more and more, it's becoming apparent, these folks exist, right? And a lot of them come out of Christian homeschooling circles, right? Again, a lot of them come out of Latter-day Saints circles. So again, there's this interesting synergy here
that I can't quite
put a finger on. But those are the kind of things that I see in terms
of fascinating. I have learned that one of the ways you can do it is those key phrases, as you were saying, key words, key phrases. Moloch worship, statist school, government school, God's law word. He won't say the word of God. He'll say the Bible is God's law word. You know, and that's a specific Rush Dooneyan thing or secular humanism. Okay, he wasn't the first person to use that term, but man, he really went to town on that. So you think, okay, that's one way I've found to pick up the sort of fingerprints of Rush Dooney on a lot of things. Like you say, it's incredibly widespread. It really is.
Yeah, law word is actually one of the best. I'm glad you brought that one up. That's a great one. If you see law word, that's probably a direct nod an indirect nod to the Institutes of Biblical Law. I think that you can almost take that back to his stuff in the late 60s, early 70s. Maybe there was someone else doing it, but I'm not aware of it. Yeah. So that's a really good key word or key phrase.
That's it. And I think too, you have to say, was there anyone before Rush Dooney that was writing the same kind of things he was? So yes, there were on some levels, like you say, he borrowed from Van Til, he borrowed from Kuyper, from Calvin, and a lot of other people. I mean, he was a voracious reader, so he was constantly devouring books, but there wasn't anyone that put it all together in that sort of comprehensive system before him. So you have to say, okay, he is certainly the father of Christian Reconstructionism, and he spawned a whole bunch of other movements. So thank you so much. I know it's getting late. I need to let you go. I was going to ask you too, how can people find you? What's the best way to get a hold of you if they wanted to have a more interesting conversation about Rush Juni?
Probably through email. You can find me on the website for the Department of Religion of Florida State. That's mm-hmm. the way. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook. I am not a social media sort of person. Right. So you'll have to reach out. It's funny to say, it's email. It's old fashioned. Right.
You're going to say, it's old school now.
Yeah. It used to be a letter and a stamp, but now it's email. So
at least email. If people still use it.
That's exactly right.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, giving us a bit more information about R.J. Rush Juni, his enduring legacy, and kind of how to find him in different places and spaces.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the interest in research and I guess also in Rush Juni. He's a fascinating guy.